our third speaker is Professor Christian Tams. He has been for a long time associated with the International Law Centre of Kiel University. He's now teaching at Glasgow University in Scotland, still part of the United Kingdom. And he's of this very special and very precious breed of international lawyers who are generalists. So he's going to comment and to give a small contribution about the issues we've been talking on the war. Christian, please.
Merci Pierre pour ces mots d'introduction et merci aussi aux organisateurs de ce colloque sur ce sujet vraiment important. Je dois avouer que pour moi c'est la première fois que je participe ou j'ai le privilège de participer au débat ici à l'ULB et en fait la première fois que je participe au débat dans le cadre de CDI qui vraiment est à mon avis point de vue d'Écosse, si vous voulez, un des centres de recherche de droit international en Europe. Ici, je regrette, je dois dire, la version française ou la partie française de ma contribution finisse assez abrupte. Et avec votre permission, je change à l'anglais, dans lequel, certainement sur des topics ou des sujets importants comme le droit international, il est plus facile de m'exprimer d'une façon express, explicite et précise, et ce que je voulais dire. Now, in English, much easier for me. You have heard two very powerful presentations, I think, which present clear views on what the law is. Certainly the first one, assez clair, c'était un des mots, was certainly one of the words often used in Olivier's presentation. And I think my task for the last presentation of this panel may be to sow some seeds of doubt among you. Maybe it's not quite as clear. And I will try to do this mainly with respect to the question of self-defense or the jus contra bellum, jus ad bellum, which formed the topic of the first presentation. Whereas on the law of occupation, I think I will focus more on the implications of this acceptance of a continued state of belligerent occupation. The short written summary I've provided tries to provide, if you want, a framework for these remarks by suggesting that when looking at sort of recent events in the Israeli-Palestine conflict, we can really clearly identify developments in international law, transformations within international law, transformations that affect the law of self-defense and that also affect the law of belligerent occupation. And I will come back to that in a minute. But in the spirit of debate, which was stressed this morning, allow me maybe one final preliminary remark that is prompted by Olivier's presentation just a couple of minutes ago. Now, as I was saying, Olivier has presented a very clear vision of a use ad bellum, jus contra bellum, which applies in interstate relations. It was, and this prompted my preliminary remark, clearer still than I would have anticipated, in that Olivier has declared not just the law of self-defense to be inapplicable, but unless I've completely misunderstood him, the whole of the jus contra bellum to be inapplicable to the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Simply three questions to maybe start debate on this. If Article 2.4, the prohibition against force, is inapplicable, why do we need Article 51? Why do we need to disqualify Israel's claim that it acted in legitimate self-defense if it hadn't violated the prohibition against the use of force in the first place? Now, of course, more fundamentally, should we accept that the prohibition against force does not apply to Israel's actions against Palestine? Do we need to accept this very strict interstate reading, not just of the right of self-defense, but also of the prohibition against force, in light of the fact that Article 2.4 speaks of the use of force in the international relations, not against another state. And do we need to accept this strict interstate reading of the prohibition against the use of force in light of the fact that, for example, Resolution 2625, which Olivier made reference to, extends the prohibition against the use of force to instances which are not interstate cross-boundary settings, but for example also comprises or declares inadmissible the use of force in violation of lines of demarcation or armistice lines. These are questions triggered by the first presentation. I wouldn't accept that the text of Article 2.4 is clear or even assez clair sur ce point. And on that basis, I would suggest that the jus contra bellum or jus ad bellum has something to say on the matter. And I take comfort, it's not purely a matter, to my view, of occupant rights, maybe of Article 43 of the Convention of the Hague Regulation, which sort of defines occupying powers, rights, and duties, or whatever other legal framework we consider might apply. And of course, while Olivier is absolutely right to say that in the Security Council resolutions there are no comparable references to Article 2.4 and Article 51 compared to other Security Council resolutions concerning interstate conflicts, I would suggest that the debates in the Security Council and the debates on Operation Cast Lead precisely indicate that states involved in the Security Council considered the jus contra bellum to be applicable, hence frequent denunciation of Israel's use of force as a violation of the prohibition against the use of force, hence some affirmations of Israel's right to use self-defense in order to justify or to rely on self-defense in order to justify its conduct, and hence also frequent criticism of Israel's proportionality or disproportionality of its actions. Wherever we stand with respect to the result, whether we think that this was a legitimate exercise of self-defense, as some said, or it was not, as most said, I think the argument were framed within the context of Articles 2.4 and Article 51, if not referred to expressly, then in the framework of those provisions. Now, and it's against this background of this preliminary remark, which no doubt requires further exploration, that I will approach Israel's claim to self-defense. And I think in this respect, we can observe a first transformation that is visible in our debates about legal issues prompted in the recent Israel-Palestinian conflict. And I think the first transformation is this. It is the gradual opening up of self-defense into a right to repel terrorist attacks. More precisely, self-defense, traditionally understood, and there I share the views expressed by many people, including Olivier this afternoon. Self-defense is still a right limited by considerations of necessity and proportionality, but the circle of armed attacks, I would argue, against which self-defense can be used has been broadened. Now, this is a transformation which is underway. The transformation, I think, is by no means complete, and it is hugely controversial. Attested, for example, by the fact that both directors of the Center Centre pour Droit International, for whom I have great respect, take the opposite views. Pierre, in his Hague lectures on le droit international à l'épreuve du terrorisme, as well as Olivier in his book on the use of force in international law. Of course, if you want more authority, you might say the ICJ is also not particularly open to this. What I would suggest is a gradual transformation, and the evidence has been presented to you. The Wall opinion, perhaps Congo, Uganda, to some extent, certainly Nicaragua. I do think, though, that the transformation is well underway, and that we have seen frequent practice of states invoking a right of self-defense against armed attack outside the circle of sort of instances which under the traditional reading would have triggered that right. And I will not go through the sort of the long list of practice. 9/11 and the aftermath is an obvious example, but it's by no means the only one. It's an example where that was near unanimity in affirming a right of self-defense, including by the Security Council. But there are many other instances. Turkey and Iran have frequently used force against rebels or terrorists, as they said, operating from within Iraq, and have claimed self-defense to justify that. Turkey's Operation Sun in northern Iraq amounted to a massive invasion. It was justified as self-defense and largely accepted, not unanimously, but largely accepted. Russia has claimed self-defense in order to use force against alleged terrorists operating from within Georgia. The African Union has agreed on a non-aggression and defense pact, which defines the harboring of terrorists as an aggression, triggering a right of self-defense. Now, none of that renders this new, broader right of self-defense uncontroversial. It remains hugely controversial. And Olivier has rightly identified the problems this broadening or these ever broader claims raise. But I think we cannot ignore the fact that in the practice of states, these claims are being made regularly, and are being made by states which are by no means Israel, the US, maybe the UK and Portugal, as in the old days. The circle of states that subscribes to this view, problematic as it may be, has widened considerably. Now, I would say, I would leave it at that. The practice is stronger than has been said so far, and we shouldn't be too certain about the narrow scope of self-defense. I would add two remarks which go to the alleged dramatic character of that transformation, which is frequently used as an argument to warn against the implications. I would say it's probably not quite as dramatic as some people say. First of all, the texts. Olivier has referred to Aggression Armée, the text of Article 51, which seems to suggest an interstate reading of the right to self-defense, sort of the key text, Article 51 on self-defense. Now, I have no issues with that. I would simply point to the English version, which speaks of armed attacks, and there's no equivalent argument available for armed attacks. Armed attacks, in fact, the British literature on the matter regularly invokes the text of Article 51 as an argument for a broader scope. Armed attacks not being armed state attacks, not necessarily. So maybe the wording, at least if we're taking into account the multilingual character of the charter rules, is not as clear-cut as was suggested. Maybe matters are not that dramatic in another respect. One gets the impression from reading debates about this problem, not so much this afternoon, but from reading the literature, that really we're witnessing a fundamental shift. But of course, the old traditional law also allowed self-defense against attacks that were carried out by non-state actors. These non-state actor attacks just had to be attributed to another state under strict rules of attribution. So I would suggest, and this is in essence sort of the Nicaragua test which was applied, which is now sort of portrayed as, if you want, the new sort of the dogma, if you want. Now, I think what we're witnessing is a gradual opening up of rules of attribution in respect of terrorism, or what we potentially see. I think this is where the transformation takes place. States are prepared to adopt broader standards of attribution in order to be able to justify their forcible responses as self-defense. We're not seeing sort of black and white changes. We're seeing a gradual opening up of standards of attribution. A final point. Self-defense, of course, remains limited by considerations of necessity and proportionality. And it is on this count, I think, that the debates in the Security Council about Israel's Operation Cast Lead are instructive, because it is on this count, I think, that even those who were going along with the transformation of the right to self-defense would argue, or argued, in fact, that Israel's actions were illegal. I will not go through the long list of statements made in the Security Council. You find the predictable ones: Israel claiming self-defense, the United States supporting it, the Arab League not supporting it. But maybe it is interesting to hear what some countries which are not maybe in one obvious camp had to say. So here are simply two or three statements in summarized form. South Africa said, We do not believe, I mean, sort of on the eve of Operation Cast Lead, Israel having just sort of begun its invasion of the Gaza Strip in early 2009, we do not believe that self-defense entitles Israel to violate rights of innocent civilians, referring to self-defense, stressing its limits. Costa Rica saying, Israel could invoke self-defense, but stressing its limits. It must not be reprisals. Vietnam says, while recognizing Israel's need for self-defense against terrorist attacks, we denounce excesses. It seemed to be that the debates with respect to Operation Cast Lead, just as much as with respect to the July War of 2006 between Israel and Hezbollah, were very much on necessity and proportionality. In fact, this is often criticized, that states avoid strict pronunciations on principled matters and easily opt for the proportionality argument. In the practice of the Security Council, at least sort of in the debates in the Security Council, this is the overriding concern. And if we're looking at the other instances which I've referred to, take Operation Sun, it is proportionality that matters, not so much the identity of the attacker or the question of whether we can firmly establish a link to a state. In short, I think that states now increasingly claim self-defense against terrorist attacks in situations which are sort of beyond the traditional Nicaragua set of attribution of non-state activities. In Cast Lead, I would say a surprisingly large number of states accepting that argument, accepted that Israel in principle was entitled to use self-defense, but vigorously denounced Israel's actions as illegal because even sort of states which are not the obvious anti-Israel states said this was really going too far. And of course, on the facts, as spelled out in many reports, you cannot but agree. Of course it was disproportionate. And I would say this shows that self-defense, even when gradually opened up, can be made applicable, can be operationalized. States could criticize Israel for having violated the limits of self-defense, even where some of these states were prepared to admit that self-defense was applicable as a matter of principle. Now, in my view, and you can sense that from the way I'm presenting this, this is less a dramatic readjustment. It is, of course, controversial, but I think if we look into the practice, the readjustment of the right of self-defense is well underway. Now, much more briefly, with respect to occupation, it seems to me that we're witnessing another transformation with respect to the law of occupation. And that is a move to a more flexible interpretation of, if you want, the requirements for there to be belligerent occupation. No preliminary remarks this time, as I find myself largely in agreement with what Vajos has had to say on this, especially if you want, juxtaposing the two readings of belligerent occupation, one stressing a more factual a test of actual control being exercised, others, like the Goldstone report, being happy with potential control that could be reactivated, as it were. I think the more flexible formulation, as it is found or as it informs, for example, the Goldstone report, which upholds that Gaza is still occupied territory, is acceptable. I think it is a meaningful adjustment of the law of belligerent occupation. I note in passing that interestingly, whereas with respect to self-defense, those critical of the alleged transformation would often refer to the ICJ, in this case, the transformation of the law of belligerent occupation has to be, if you want, opposed against the ICJ, because I think the Congo-Uganda judgment of 2005 provides strong support for the more restrictive view, where the court, I'm not sure I brought the statement, but I'm probably speaking long enough anyway, where the court said Ugandan forces would not only have to be stationed in particular locations, but they had to have substituted their own authority for that of the host state government. It's a very restrictive approach that informs the recent ICJ judgment. So it's an interesting, if you want, change of matters that with respect to one transformation, the traditionalists cling to the ICJ and refer to the ICJ's authority. In the other transformation, the ICJ is again sort of restrictive, but people like in the Goldstone report who want to apply the law of occupation have to sort of maybe ignore or pass lightly over what the ICJ has had to say. Finally, simply as a almost as a glossator to what Vaios has said, two or three questions raised by this move, this transformation of the law of belligerent occupation. I think we must look at the implication and an indirect effects of occupation in these new, more flexible settings. And there, I think, the interesting questions arise. Normally, occupation, of course, I mean, why do we refer to it? We refer to it partly because we want to identify duties of the occupying power, but we also refer to occupation as a nice shortcut to attribution of conduct, to extraterritorial application of human rights standards. It's a convenient argument because occupation has traditionally served for these sorts of arguments. Now, if we accept more flexible forms of occupation, I think we cannot always use these shortcuts anymore. Can we really say that Israel, for example, has to observe human rights within the occupied Gaza Strip after its withdrawal, even if it only exercises potential control? Of course it has to observe human rights when it activates its control. That's beyond doubt. That was the Goldstone setting, if you want. But if it has pulled out, is it really in a position to guarantee human rights in the Gaza Strip? The Al-Skaini case, which some of you may be familiar with in British courts, it was, in my view, the first to point to a dichotomy that we might accept flexible occupation, but then we could no longer accept the duty to observe human rights extraterritorially. So there may be, the shortcut may be blocked. Similarly, and much more briefly, state responsibility. Think of Congo, Uganda, state responsibility, rules of attribution, questions of attribution being made so easy by the fact that you had a system of occupation in place. That, of course, doesn't work if you rely on occupation based on flexible control. You will have to go the extra mile and prove attribution in a more cumbersome way. Finally, a point that probably will come up in the debate, if we think of the law of occupation superimposing itself upon the jus contra bellum, then again, if we accept flexible rules of belligerent occupation, that argument becomes much more tenuous. Now, to conclude, which was probably a somewhat more unorganized presentation because I wanted to bring out points of the potential for debate, let me say this by way of conclusion. Israel-Palestine is, of course, a very special case, and it's always referred to that. It was referred to that in this morning's presentation. It was referred to that in the introduction, even. Normally, for international lawyers, it's quite a frustrating case. It doesn't provide much comfort for those who, like Richard Goldstone, who recently put it in this Wall Street Journal article, which disowned parts of the Goldstone report. He said, for those of us who believe in the cause of establishing and applying international law to protected and deadly conflicts, if that's your task or your cause in life, then the Israel-Palestine conflict is quite frustrating. However, notwithstanding the frustration, I think we can look at it from a different perspective as well. And I think we realize from the way these debates are going that international law is constantly invoked by both sides. No doubt it is bent by either side in order to suit a given purpose. It is by no means neutral. But I think we can see in these two instances on which I focus, law of occupation and law of self-defense, that maybe the Israel-Palestine conflict serves, or arguments made in the course of that conflict serve or allow us to sort of highlight developments in international law more generally. And I readily admit, and this shall be my last sentence, that when trying to, if you want, trace these modifications, trace trends in state practice, one can easily be accused of, if you want, giving up the nice and clear-cut and easy, clean vision of international law, towering above reality, and one gets one's hands dirty. But this may be preferable to a clear vision of international law which does not engage with the reality on the ground, and it may be a necessary implication of the attempt to speak law to power. Many thanks.
Merci, Christian.